Good evening, everyone. My name is Cynthia Delastrinos Johnson. I am the chair of the Planning Community Development Committee at Change. I'm here with my fellow council members, Councilmember Quinn and Councilmember Hogarty, and also Laurel Humphrey, our legislative analyst. Thank you all who are joining us online. We are really glad that you are here for today's agenda. Our first agenda item is a proposal regarding tiny house villages, and I believe Max Baker will open that item up for us.
Great, thank you. It looks like we have a few more people coming into the lobby right now.
Hello. Can you see me? This is Tracy. Can you see me, Josh?
Yep. Yep, I can see you. Hi, Tracy.
Hi, Josh.
Joining us.
Great. And something that maybe I would recommend is it's not too difficult. Maybe we turn off our incoming video for those who aren't speaking. I see quite a few screens on right now, so we'll try to focus on those who are speaking during the meeting. So when it's your turn to speak, we'll bring that video on. Hopping right into it, I'm Max Baker, Development Supervisor for the Department of Community Development, and this item was brought by Nora Gerlach, who is out this week on much deserved vacation to see her son at college, so feel happy for her. So I'll just be presenting this item. Essentially, this is going to segue into a presentation from Lehigh, and then I'll let them kind of take it from there, and then I'll wrap it up again at the end. So I'll just provide a quick introduction into what's being presented by Lehigh tonight. So Lehigh is the Low Income Housing Institute, and they have applied for a King County ARPA grant to establish and run two tiny house villages in Tukwila for a period of 2 years. And I think we've got a few background
Max, this is Rachel. I'm going to go ahead and mute everyone who's not speaking at the moment. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Rachel. Great. Thanks, Rachel. Again, Lehigh has applied for an ARPA grant to run two tiny house villages in Tukwila for a period of 2 years, and staff is seeking direction regarding these proposals. I'll go through this relatively quick in the memo since it's going to be redundant to the presentation, but essentially the two sites that Lehigh has proposed are the Miracle Temple of God site at 14925 Interurban Avenue South, which would be for 28 tiny houses with the potential for up to 33 residents, and then the Riverton United Methodist Church at 3118 South 140th Street with a proposal for 20 tiny houses with the potential to serve up to 24 residents. So a little bit of background information. Last year, in response to recently adopted state legislation, Tukwila revised its zoning code per ordinance 2658 to allow emergency housing and shelters in zones RC and higher, subject to siting and operational criteria. TMC 1850-260 also allows transitional supportive housing in all residential areas, subject to a maximum of 15 residents in low-density residential or LDR districts. However, the state legislation and the revised TMC legislation anticipate that the housing and shelters would occur within permanent structures. And you can find in the informational memo a little bit of background of that RCW, emergency housing versus emergency shelter definition, as well as transitional housing. Tiny house villages are not directly addressed within our codes, but the use could fall within the city's discretion to allow pursuant to the following note in Land Use Table 18.6. So Table 18.6 is our land uses permitted by district. And that note is that the director will make a determination for uses not specifically listed in the zoning code. The director will consider whether the proposed uses either A, similar in nature to and compatible with other uses permitted outright within a similar zone, B, consistent with the stated purpose of the zone, or C, consistent with the policies of the Tukwila Comprehensive Plan. Additionally, the council could direct staff to review sample codes and propose tiny house specific regulations that council could adopt into the TMC zoning code. Examples to consider are Seattle's transitional encampment program regulations at SMC 234256 and King County's codes for temporary small house sites. King County's tiny house regulations expire in May of 2022, 1 year after adoption. And the code development review and adoption process would take at least 6 to 8 months. So I'll come back to the recommendation afterwards. I'm going to just go ahead and let Lehigh take it from here. And whoever would be speaking from Lehigh primarily, they can turn on their camera. And if they'd like to share the presentation as well, which is included in tonight's agenda packet, they're welcome to do that now as well. I'm not sure if we'll need to share permissions for sharing screen. If someone could confirm that for me, that'd be great.
Yeah. Hi there, Maxwell. My name is John Grant with Lehigh, and I would need to be able to share my screen.
Great. Let's see if we can provide you with that option. Okay, I think you've been made into a presenter, so hopefully you have the option now.
Yes, I'm working on that now. Awesome. All right, one moment. So hopefully you can see it, though I'm looking on your screen. It looks like it's a little cropped, unfortunately.
Should I begin
or should we try to adjust the screen?
I think it might be helpful to adjust. Is it on a secondary monitor, John?
It is on a secondary monitor.
I wonder if we move it from that monitor to the other. Oh, that looked good, actually, for a second there. So I think when it goes into slideshow mode, it must be.
Let me try this one more time. No, it's still cropped, huh?
Still cropped. Interesting.
Well, I'll tell you what. Why don't I do this? I can share it not in slideshow mode. It looks like you guys can read it for the most part.
Yeah. And we have it in our packets as well.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry for the technical problem there.
There's always one. There's always one technical problem.
I know. In this modern age we live in. Well, everybody, in the interest of time, I'm just going to continue forward, if that sounds good to the committee.
Yes.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much. We are short on time, so I'm going to be as brief as possible. My name is John Grant. I'm the Chief Strategy Officer for the Low Income Housing Institute, and we are going to do some very brief introductions. This is the panel today. Everybody will have an opportunity to kind of introduce themselves in greater detail later in the presentation. So I'm just going to briefly go over that. We have Pastor Henry Jenkins with us with the Miracle Temple Church of God in Christ, Pastor Jan Bullerjack with the Riverton Park United Methodist Church, Benton Koblenz with the Tukwila Food Pantry, Tracy Williams, who is a Lehigh staff person, and they also a former village resident, myself, Josh Castle, who is the Director of Community Engagement at Lehigh, and Brad Gerber, our Lehigh Senior Projects Manager. So just a real brief overview of the Low Income Housing Institute. We are an affordable housing provider. We have over 3,000 units of affordable housing in 6 different counties in the Puget Sound region. We've been around for over 30 years. We have 2 urban rest stops that provide hygiene services, and we also are very proud of our Tiny House Village program. It's an innovative emergency shelter program with over 16 villages throughout Washington State. We have a village in Bellingham, Skyway, and multiple in the city of Seattle. Here we go, in Seattle, Skyway, Tacoma, Olympia, and Bellingham. What are tiny houses? They are high-quality, non-congregate, COVID-safe enhanced shelters. Each tiny house is 8 by 12 feet, insulated, heated. They have electricity and, most importantly, a locking door. Villages include a hygiene and kitchen facilities, community spaces, and offices for on-site staff. Villages serve populations not traditionally served by shelters, such as families, couples, and people with pets, which are often barriers for people who are trying to access shelter. Here are some great photos of our tiny house village, the True Hope Village, which is on 18th and Yesler in the city of Seattle. The houses are colorful and bright and happy places to live. Here is one of our newest villages, Rosie's Village on Roosevelt up in North Seattle. And there's some of our staff. And then here is our progressive Skyway Village, which was also recently opened. This is, you see, they have very broad support. We have Pastor Curtis Taylor there, Senator Rebecca Saldana, King County Councilmember Gourmet Zahalai, as well as Minister Kathy Taylor with the Seattle Word of God Church. So inside a tiny house, it's basically a little one bedroom apartment. They're spacious. They have windows. There's beds. We have a welcome kit for folks and a little mini fridge there. And then this is some examples of our community kitchens. And I think actually I might be eating into Brad's part of the presentation. Brad, do you want to take it over from here?
I'm happy to. Can you hear me, John? Yeah. Or others?
Yep.
Awesome. Yeah. Yes. So John was correct in his speaking. The tiny houses are about 100 square feet. They're insulated to residential standards. They each have power, heat inside, beds, clothing storage, two windows, moisture mitigation and mold mitigation systems. The kitchen spaces that are shown above, one of them is in a fire-rated outdoor community tent, and the other one is in a permitted modified shipping container structure. So we've done a few different options, but community spaces are where there's communal meals, there's food prep area, often places for people to congregate and get together when the weather is inclement. There's always hygiene facilities. So in these proposals, there would certainly be showers, toilets, laundry that's also available. Oftentimes that's done in a separate either UL listed or LNI approved shower trailer or hygiene trailer, such as the one shown, which is fully accessible. So that's something that we always do. Go to the next slide as well. And there might be some, what of a delay. Oh yeah, and then there's always the staff offices. So as shown, those are two different tiny houses where staff, in this instance, the case manager at Rosie's Tiny House Village or the case manager at True Hope's Tiny House Village would be 9 to 5 or outside of that range working with clients in one of the spaces.
Great, and I'll turn it over to Josh for slide 12.
Great, thank you. The villages have full-time staffing, 24-hour staffing. We have a manager that manages the site, the case manager who is crucial to the program, who provides services and support, including obtaining housing, employment, access to healthcare, getting IDs, and more. We also have village organizers that provide the security and operational support around the clock. We have a code of conduct that the residents agree to and abide by as a condition of staying at the site, and all residents are required to sign that and follow that. We also employ grievance procedures to address any resident concerns. So our supportive services case managers are crucial to the program. Like I said, they provide a range of services, but the thing that is most crucial about their work is that they help residents move into permanent housing. So the tiny house villages serve as a stepping stone from homelessness to permanent housing. So it's not a place to stay. It's a place to get the services that they need and moved, get stable, take a breath, recover from the trauma of living outside, and then take those steps to move into permanent housing, working with a case manager. We have very high success rate of moving people into permanent housing. So 56% of the village residents who exited villages found homes. 50% of those was into permanent housing, 6% into transitional housing. The tiny house villages have always consistently, year to year, had a significantly higher exit rate to permanent housing than all other shelter programs. They also have a 114-day median length of stay. How we do community outreach and engagement, we form a community advisory committee of neighbors, businesses, religious organizations, rotary clubs, chambers of commerce, people in the neighborhood that are all in close proximity to a village, that all monitor the progress of the village and hear reports from staff and provide feedback. We also have a community meeting that neighbors are invited to. We flyer the whole neighborhood, we canvas everyone, and then people come to the community meeting where they can bring their questions, their concerns, their ideas. These are open to the public, and we try to basically, you know, send out emails to everyone and get everyone there. We also have volunteers that set up the village, so neighbors and volunteers come together to do that. And then I just want a quick snapshot. We had a tour at Progressive Skyway Village. So several of you in this meeting were in that tour, so thanks for joining us. And this just shows a couple pictures of that beautiful day, which we were lucky to have.
And we want to thank so much for members of the City Council who joined us, as well as the mayor and members of the planning department as well. So here we are, our proposal to King County and the City of Tukwila. We submitted an application for $2.3 million for a two-year period for 50 tiny houses at two locations. And I apologize, it looks like I had a little bit of a typo. I believe that's 28 houses instead of 30, but at the top there's 20 tiny houses at the Riverton Park United Methodist Church, which would be operated by the Low Income Housing Institute. And there's the address there on 140th. And then we've got 28 to 30 tiny houses sponsored by the Miracle Temple Church of God in Christ, which would also be operated by Lehigh, located at the inner urban site. And I'm going to turn it over to Pastor Bullerjack to talk about the Riverton Park Methodist Church and their participation here. So Pastor Bullerjack, why don't you go ahead?
Hi. I'm speaking to you from Maryland, where my grandchildren are supposed to be going to bed, but one of them is now walking through the camera. Thanks for having us. As you know, Riverton Park has had a camping program there for many years. There's a picture of it. We've had a tiny home village without the tiny homes. So we're really looking forward to this project to be able to get those folks into warm, dry space with doors that lock. They deserve it, and they've all been working hard together to get this in place. So I will turn it over now to, I think to Benton, who's going to talk about the wraparound services and what we can offer beyond just the property.
Yeah, thank you, Jan. Yeah, my name's Benton. I'm the board chair for Tukwila Pantry. We're proudly sponsored by the Riverton Park United Methodist Church, and we've been serving our community for over 20 years now. We partner with the church to provide, of course, food services to the folks who live on campus, but we also provide opportunities, for those folks to volunteer at the pantry and even to work their way up to get a living wage job at the pantry when one is available. We over the course of this past 2 years, I think, have confronted some of the biggest challenges that we ever could have imagined in our 20-year history, serving unprecedented numbers of folks from our community who needed food services and who were facing food insecurity. We, of course, partnered with the church and with the clothing bank to confront emergency situations like the fire at the Maplecrest apartment complex where we created the donation center. And the thing that I want to impress upon this committee is that we could not have survived this pandemic as the pantry. We could not have done the things that we did without the folks who live on the Riverton Park United Methodist campus. They have such big hearts and are so giving to our community that we have been able to pack boxes on the days when there were no volunteers, right? And we were able to run the donation center even late into the night because of those folks and because of their, not because they had to, but because they wanted to serve and give back to our community. And I am so excited for this project, for the possibility of this tiny home village, because right now, you saw it a little while ago, the folks who live on campus, they live in tents. They are exposed to the elements, to the winter storms and the rainstorms and the wind. And the idea that our community can give back and provide them with these tiny homes, that's why I'm excited about this project. And that's what really makes my heart going. So I had 1 minute scheduled, but I could talk for hours and hours about how excited I am about this project. But I want to hand it over to, I think it is Pastor Jenkins up next, to talk about a little bit about the Miracle Life Temple Church site on Interurban.
And we just rolled through some of the 3D renderings of the Riverton site, so I hope you all were seeing that on the screen. Pastor Jenkins, whenever you're ready.
Yes. Good evening, Pastor Jenkins of Miracle Temple Church of God in Christ. In past 40 years.
We can hear you just fine, Pastor.
Okay. All right. Keep going.
Yes, sir. If you just want to talk about your background and the work the church has done, go right ahead.
Yes, been pastoring 40 years in the Seattle area. I was called by God in 1976, began pastoring in 1980. I built my first church in 1982. I've been the owner of 4 churches in Seattle. My desire to host the village is similar to what I've been doing for the past 40 years. More, but on a larger scale. I was thankful for a chance to help those God sent my way. In some cases, we didn't even have what they needed, but we networked and worked closely with other church local pastors in the city. As a minister, we got to see the poor and vulnerable people reclaim their lives and become productive and members of society and bless others. My plans Miracle Temple is to continue to move forward with the remodeling. My role as a pastor is still very involved. I continue to perform all my pastoral duties. The truth of the church is the body of Christ and not the building. We welcome Lehi to our property. I want to say that Lehi did not contact me. I contacted Lehi in the beginning and told him that God had put on my heart to let a tiny village come to the property. Thank you, Pastor Jenkins.
Thank you so much, Pastor. And as the committee can see, we've got some really great renderings. I hope that you can see them on your screen that we would have on site at Pastor Jenkins' property. Again, this is property owned by his church. We've got a nice fenced off area. This would be a slightly larger site with 28 to 30 houses. We wanted to be sure that you could see some of these images and kind of have time to to ask any questions that you might have of the panel. And again, we really appreciate your time and taking into consideration this presentation. We're very excited by these partnerships, and we're very hopeful that we can bring these resources to the Tukwila community.
I just want to mention as well, thank you for that, John, that Tracy Williams is with us, and she's just going to share a quick snapshot of who she is, and then she's going to be available to answer questions.
You know, I'm so sorry, Tracy. I apologize to the committee. Tracy Williams is one of our amazing staff members who has an amazing story. And Tracy, if you could please share your story. I'm so sorry I skipped over you. Tracy, are you still there? You just need to unmute your microphone there. Hit the mic icon. So Tracy, we can't hear you. I'm not sure if you can unmute your microphone. There should be a mute button on your screen.
Me?
There you go. Now we can hear you. Please go ahead.
Hi, my name is Tracy. I'm a former resident at True Hope Village on 18th and Yesler. I stayed there towards the end of January of 2020, right when the COVID hit. And so I had, when I moved, I had nowhere to go, and no place to stay. So I went to, my sister and I walked all the way downtown, reached the Catholic Community Services. They told us to go talk to Pastor Jeffrey. So Pastor Jeffrey told me to come follow him, and he took me to True Hope. And this was on a Tuesday. And so I moved in at Friday. When I moved in at Friday, I had two storage containers. So when I moved into the tiny houses, I felt very hopeless. I just didn't want to be here on this earth anymore. But when I got into the tiny house, I felt safe, 24-hour staff. I was able to take care of my mental health well-being, my glasses, and all those other good things that that you can't do when you're out on the streets and when you're homeless and when you're living in a car. So Lehigh gave me the opportunity to get back on my feet. So April of 2020, I started working for Lehigh. And I April of this year will be 2 years that I've been working from them. So I moved into the Jensen Block on East Lake and Mercer, and now I am in a brand new apartment building, the George Fleming Place, and it's a wonderful building, wonderful building. I never in my life as a child or adult would think that I would move in a brand new building that no one has ever lived in. So Lehigh has gave me the opportunity to get back on my feet, and I know this program works, and if we could get just more tiny houses, a person like me who's a living, walking witness will let you know that this program works. I don't want to see people out there in soggy grass and wet or walking around with drippy clothes. I want to see people be able to stay in a small place, a little tiny house, get their life together and get their stuff back on their feet, because you know once upon a time, he or she didn't live like that. It's something that happened in he or she life. They got them where they was, just like with my situation. Something happened with me that got me and made me become homeless. But I reached out and Lehigh has been helping me ever since. Now I'm a village organizer. And I love what I do. I work at TC Spirit on 22nd and Cherry. I love what I do because I'm giving something back that was freely given to me. And I love working with the residents.
Tracy, thank you so much for sharing your story. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
We wanted to leave time as much as we can for the committee to ask questions to the panel. So if you have any questions, we'd love to answer them.
Thank you. I'll go ahead and jump to questions from council members. Councilmember Hogarty?
Yeah, I'll ask. I have a couple, so maybe I'll just so we can take turns because okay. Somebody else might ask my question. The first question that I want to ask is what is the role of the overseeing church in the administration and of the day-to-day operations at the tiny village?
That's a great question. I think I might tag team with Josh a little bit here, but Lehigh would be the operator. So we would have a case manager on site. We would have a village operations manager who also works on site. And we would have village organizers on site to staff the different locations. And I think the slight difference is with Reverend Bullerjack's site is that the church would provide a more hands-on support because they actually have folks that are also working pretty close on site as well. Josh, do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, so I think the church's role in both cases would be providing, working with us to provide support and services to the residents in a variety of ways. Just an example is with the Riverton side, of course. They have the Quilla food pantry right there on site. They have the clothing donation area. They have some services built in so that we would work with them. We would work with the church on a lot of the services that they already provide. And then of course we'd work with Pastor Jenkins on his site. Pastor Jenkins, I'm sure, would organize donations and food and services for the residents. So we would work in partnership with them, but Lehigh is the operator. And we provide the 24/7 staff. So we provide that support around the clock.
So the church organizes the food?
I think they would do a lot of organizing.
Donations and food. And what was the other thing? Clothing.
Clothing or any services that the church is interested in providing to assist the residents on their journey to get into housing.
And what Lehigh provides is the case manager, which does, that's the big lift to get them into housing.
Yep.
And what other things does the case manager do? Just some examples.
Yeah, so the case manager, you know, a lot of people that are that come in from, like, a lot of times from chronic homelessness, they have no ID or documentation on them. Like, they don't, they have no way to prove who they are. So that's one example of one crucial service that is almost unappreciated, but it's so important, that they help people getting their documentation and their ID and navigating that process when they have no way of proving who they are to begin with. They're especially equipped and talented to be able to do so. And then they start looking at, you know, once they get their ID, first they're recovering from trauma a lot of times, but then once they get their ID, they get their documentation, they look at what is the housing out there that's available. Let's look at applying for housing. Let's look at, you know, do you need to apply for, you know, some sort of income support, like food benefits, things like that, to get you on your feet as you're working on getting to housing. And Tracy can actually answer some questions around this too.
That's fine. That gives me the general idea. Thank you. Yeah. Just in this interest of time. So that I'll, I can ask another question later. Yeah.
Okay. Council Member Quinn.
So one, I want to just thank everyone for their presentation, and for the sake of time, I can't say all the things, but very good presentation. So I'll just ask some targeted questions, and I have a couple questions for staff. But this would be to kind of Lehigh the operator. Just on the along the same lines, who would be responsible, let's say, for example, permit compliance? And I ask the question to say that what we're starting to see is developments. But, you know, take the tiny homes aside, but I pretty much compare them as kind of traditional structures that we've seen, and we're starting to see commercial kitchens and laundry rooms and other things. All these things that maybe none of us could have anticipated as far as a change, but it, to me, it's the same thing, and it just sounds like it's all separated. So who would be responsible kind of for the permit compliance, right? Because just like if you're a homeowner, you know, you got to make sure your plumbing's right. You got to make sure you're, if you're doing a commercial kitchen, that you have the various pieces. So I'm just wondering who would be the respondent in that case.
Yeah, that would be Lehigh. And Brad, do you want to speak about how we do permitting for some of the facilities? Is Brad there?
There's a little lag on my side.
There he is. Pardon
me. Can't hear me. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
If you could speak up, that'd be helpful.
I would just say, sure. Lehigh would be the permitting agency, so we would apply for all permits. Also work directly with the city of Tukwila to determine exactly which permits would be required and would be necessary, and we would operate the program within whatever permits are deemed essential, which does sometimes vary based on the jurisdiction. So whether it's like a land use code or whether it's a specific trade permit, with all of our villages, though, all of our contracted trade work does fall under trade permits. We work closely in King County with, for example, public health, all the kind of inspections department, all the different groups. So we would hope to meet with someone in the city of Tukwila to exactly figure that out. What pieces of code are relevant? Who would be inspecting? We do everything above the board. So we would certainly want to make sure that there's folks available to see all that work.
Great. My second question, and thank you for that answer, is, you know, another thing that no one else realizes, attaining a traditional single family home is just almost astronomical. So we know that we have to look at different ways of approaching it. So I would say this to all, and I don't require an answer unless you feel the need, but there's a little bit of education similar to what's going on here that will need to occur with the residents. And just wondering your willingness to help us all kind of educate the experience and inform folks in this community, because one example, went to 7-Eleven. If you're really like aware, saw a whole family, they were all covered up and they were sleeping at noon. That says a lot, right? That says it's here and that says it's everywhere. And so this is an option for us to consider. And then my next question is just for staff.
Yeah, we engage really closely with the community, and we do a lot of canvassing of the neighborhood. So we actually have like flyers, and we go around and knock on doors and see if they answer the door, and have a conversation to answer the questions or any concerns that may come up.
We, you know, on the flyer, we have a lot of informational stuff about the village, but then we invite them to the, you know, we always have an invitation to a community meeting, and we send out the flyers maybe a couple weeks before that meeting. We go around and pass out the flyers, and we go out about 5 blocks in all directions from the site. And then we do, if we can't reach a business or, you know, a group or something that's close by, we'll call them, or we'll call, we'll email, we'll do everything we can to reach them, to inform them about the community meeting and answer all their, you know, questions and make them aware of the village program and just be able to address those things. We also like ongoing community engagement. We form a, all the villages, literally all 16 of them, have a community advisory committee of neighbors and businesses and faith organizations and others. And these are not necessarily cheerleaders. You know, these are folks that are there on their, you know, come together that have, they may want to bring a concern, but they also may want to help with donations and provide a service. But they're neighbors that are right in close proximity of the site and are real neighborhood stakeholders. So we work really closely with the community around neighbors, and they meet every month, you know, for about an hour and a half. So it's a regular public meeting that everyone's invited to.
And maybe my last question, and maybe this can be around, this is a staff question around, you know, kind of in the packet, it talks about the definitions of emergency housing. And then there's also reference to RCW, but there was also some legislation that was passed around making accommodations. In this process, is that considered in evaluating this proposal, Mr. Maxwell?
Sorry, as far as providing additional definitions within our code?
Well, yeah, that was that wasn't a question, but I'm saying that the fact that this is before us could also be in response to the state legislation that was passed, and then also the implementation of the RCW and the definition. So I'm assuming that both of these facilities potentially qualify as emergency housing, emergency shelters, and transitional housing. Am I correct about that?
That's my understanding.
Okay. And let's just say, although it's different, you know, what we're looking at are the same type of codes and permits that we would look at, let's say, for, again, multifamily housing, minus the additional definitions. I just wanted to confirm that that's the case.
That's right. So we would kind of have them go through the similar permitting process that we would for most home, you know, building permits for structures like this. We did a pre-application early on, actually, for the one on Interurban, and there was discussions about needing to meet the fire department's access requirements and making sure that spacing between the buildings is sufficient enough to provide egress and that, you know, fire walls or at least fire separation would exist. So they would have to go through those requirements. They'd be a little bit different than our typical building permits because they do kind of fall within a size threshold. So like permanent foundations are typically part of like a building permit, for example. These would be a little bit different, but they would still be held to similar standards where they would need to be fixed to the ground, not on wheels, which isn't a permitted type of housing. Those parts of our code would still apply to these types of structures.
Okay, and then the 16 other villages, I think you rattled off other kind of like codes. You know, I'd love to kind of see a list of additional codes, but there were other jurisdictions that weren't articulated by you, but I want to make sure we're fully representative and being able to show the swath of codes and other things, and then I have a like request when this moves on to committee of the whole. But
just to let you know,
I have one question, and then one clarifying question for staff, trying to understand what's being requested of this committee before it goes to the committee of the whole. So my question is, there was mention in here that there is a potential of 2-year funding from the county for this project. My question is this is the vision for this to be a two-year project or beyond that? And if it's beyond that, you know, what are the plans for funding beyond those 2 years?
Is that a question to Lehigh, the council member?
Yes.
Okay.
I think so.
I wasn't sure. Yes, we're happy to answer those questions. It has been our experience that once we get a shelter program up and running, it is considered a temporary facility, right? We want to end homelessness. That is our goal. And we are very sensitive to the needs of the community. We do have a number of programs that have been going on for more than 2 years. And as far as the funding goes, I think that there is very, very strong support from the King County Council for the Tiny House Village program. And I can't make promises on their behalf, but we would be very strong advocates to continue funding in the future if that is something that the community desired. And furthermore, I really want to point out here and really thank Pastor Jenkins in particular. The money available for this project would not have been in existence if Pastor Jenkins had not met with the King County Council and advocated for these resources for his community. And really just want to thank him and recognize the advocacy that he did that created this opportunity in the first place. And we have no doubt that everybody on this call, including Reverend Bowler Jack, as well as Pastor Jenkins and everyone else, will be strong proponents for the program moving forward.
Thank you. And then my next question is for staff. What do you need from us to move this forward? And then I'm also conscious that Councilmember Quinn will have something he wanted to add, and I will also pass it to Councilmember Hogarty after we're hoping to conclude around 3 minutes if we can, because we have a tight agenda today. So staff, and then Councilmember Hogarty, and then Councilmember Quinn.
Great, thanks. So it's my understanding what being requested of the committee tonight is that if the larger concerns around the proposal from Lehigh are relatively addressed, that this would be able to move to the committee of the whole for a larger discussion with the entire group, and that this would be treated in a similar manner to what we've done for the 10 cities in the past, which would essentially not have to have it go through the land use permitting process. So, you know, they wouldn't need a land use determination. They wouldn't need a special permit in that sense. It would be held to the typical kind of like development permit, electrical plumbing permits that may be required, but discussions around some of the, I guess, the details for this would be handled at the COW. So it would be a continuation of this discussion, but essentially kind of agreeing that this wouldn't necessarily need to go through a land use process and that we can continue to talk about what would be required for them to move the project forward.
Okay, thank you. Councilmember Hogarty?
Yeah, and I think that was the timing and urgency of this juxtaposed with page 2. It says, additionally, the council could direct staff to review sample codes and propose tiny house specific regulations. I think we need to take a look at that. So how we could do that in a timely manner, but that is something that we need to do. We just can't, my opinion is we can't just give a green light for the tiny houses.
Yes.
So it says we could, and I say we should. And so that was my only other comment. I'm in support of moving this to the COW.
Okay.
Yeah, that was actually almost in this, well, it's in line with, what I was going to say, but I would just say that there was some legislation that all jurisdictions have to act, and I think some of that information should be in the packet before it goes to COW. And then the second thing is, Councilmember Horry said, is that we kind of really got to give it a best effort to find similar or appropriate codes and definitions that would allow this project to go forward. And then that's also part of kind of being innovative is making sure that we have the processes too, whether it be to have it get started and then also for the operations of it, so that if something were to occur, we don't have kind of a stop project because we actually have went through the codes and permitting process, and the expectations are not only known by the applicants, but also by the city. So that would be, you know, the hope is that staff can do it, and I think it's prudent for us to consider those things.
Okay. I agree to this paragraph around council could direct staff to review sample codes for proposed specific regulations, since right now there's not anything specific in our codes directed to tiny homes. I think it would, I agree, at least information about that. I recognize that it also says that this process would take at least 6 to 8 months. We don't want to delay, but we also want to do what we need to do to create a process that makes it flow from now on. So I think that it should be added. Is that enough direction for staff? I think that from this point it can. We feel comfortable moving it on to the COW.
Yes, okay. I think in favor of, yes.
Great.
Absolutely.
All right. So it will move on. Thank you all so much for attending the meeting, and we hope to see you back at that meeting.
Council members, we're overjoyed to hear that, and we really appreciate your thoughtful consideration of this proposal, and we really can't thank you enough for the time that you took today and to hear us out. So thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
Thank you all.
Yeah, thank you all.
Thank you.
All right. We'll see you later.
Council Chair, I'm going to step out for the next item because I won't be acting on it here or a full council.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Where are we going to find you when we need to bring you back? Out in the hall.
Will you be? Okay.
Oh. I'll track him down.
Don't track him down. Yeah. All right. The next item on our agenda is the Wattagier Development Agreement, and Brandon will be leading that discussion for us.
Good evening.
Brandon, I just want to give you a heads up. If we could keep the presentation to 5 minutes or less, that would be great, just because we're on a time crunch.
No, I totally understand. So I just what we're hoping to get tonight is some direction from the committee regarding some of the issues related to the Wattagier project. As the committee remembers, about 2 weeks ago, myself and Rebecca Boucher presented on the Wattagier development agreement up on 141st and Tukwila International Boulevard, and we highlighted three of the main issues: structured parking, the required number of parking, and setbacks. The memo that you have before goes more into depth related to parking and on the setback issue. I'm going to jump ahead and talk about the setback real fast because that's actually a much more simpler issue than we realized. We were able to look at a site map and get a little bit more detail about what our code requires. And only on the south property line do we have a setback issue for the second and third stories and higher. Our code requires a tiered setback. The development can't meet that because of the construction type, but it meets the first floor setbacks of 10 feet. And so we have suggested what we put in the staff report is a suggestion on how to address that issue, which is we would require a certain amount of articulation and detailing that would be done and approved as part of a design review application by the director. The next issue, which I think is one of the biggest issues, is parking. And so what you have in your staff report is everything that we have related to parking, and a study that was done by Wattagier and the TransPro group looking at what should be the allowable number of parking stalls for the project. And that study concluded that 92 parking stalls would be sufficient for this project, mainly because of the overlap and the shared parking between the residential and the commercial uses. Those stalls would be both on-site and off-site. And so staff looked at some other documents that we had related to parking, specifically a study that was done by DCD for the Bellwether project, which also concluded that we were overparking our apartment buildings, specifically our affordable housing projects, as well as looking at the right size parking study, which also concluded that we were overparking. And so what DCD and economic development staff worked on was a recommendation to address parking. And I'm going to go through this recommendation because it's really the heart of what we're hoping to have a discussion with the committee tonight. The first is that this site would be required to have 125 parking stalls. Now, that is more than what Transpo and even our own analysis says is the minimum. What we're doing is providing a buffer. In case we need additional parking, we would have that buffer. That 125 parking stalls would be both on-site and off-site on 141st and 42nd Avenue with on-street parking. And if you look in figure one, is a conceptual design. This is a very back of napkin. It has not been reviewed by Public Works yet to show how that parking could be laid out. So that's 125 parking stalls, give or take, right there. The next is Forterra would be required to secure 25 parking stalls on a nearby property for up to 5 years. And during that time, the city will review the parking and waive the requirement if not needed. So that gets us another 25, so now we're up to 150 parking stalls. And the next suggestion that staff has is that Forterra would provide the city a one-time payment as a parking mitigation fee. The city would use the funds to complete additional studies for post-project to see how the parking is working out, and could also use the funds for parking signage, enforcement, and the creation of a residential parking zone if needed. If legally allowed, any unused funds would be remitted back to the co-op owners to provide them an incentive to effectively manage the parking. So this gets us 150 parking stalls on and off-site for the initial 5 years of the project. So I want to talk about what next steps are. We would like feedback from the committee on this. If this is something that you believe that you can support as well as the whole council, what we would want to do is go to Public Works and start working on a detailed to have them examine the parking on 141st and 42nd Avenue to see if that's something that can work, what's the total number that we can get in there with the design. And then we would come back to COW with a presentation and a recommendation on that, on parking and setbacks and some, which the parking is the biggest issue. And so we just wanted to kind of start checking with the committee to get these items checked off as we move forward with the development agreement request from Forterra. So with that, that concludes my presentation. Chair, sorry, I'm just.
I know, kinda,
he's trying to go fast.
He's trying to go quickly.
So, Councilmember Hogarty,
do you want to start this?
I really like this recommendation. I'm in favor of moving it forward. That's all. I think the parking was the biggest issue. This seems to, you know, the number of parking stalls that is recommended or that we're trying to get here seems to get us closer to something that is reasonable. And I appreciate it. I would love to see this move forward and see what we can do. Councilmember Hogarty.
Yeah, I think we're getting there, right? We're going to get there. But I do have a couple questions. The first one is that we were talking, you mentioned the bellwether said, yeah, well, we are going to do the right size parking. Well, we have no feedback from that. That's what I, you know, it's like we did it, but we don't know. Is it working? Is it not? Is it successful? Is it not? So really, before I make any decision, I'd like to hear from somebody somehow about how that's going with the one park, with the one spot per unit. And now, you don't really see any parking up and down the street because there's some towing there, but I just would like, perhaps you could just contact Bellwether and say, how's it going? What's going on here? I want to know that.
So if I could answer that real fast, Councilor. Remember, I did contact Bellwether. We were working, having them help look at our parking. I had to track down some information, and I asked them that question. I said, do you see any parking issue? Are you having any issues? And they said everything, they're leased up, and that everything was working out, and that they were not seeing any parking issues. That was what Bellwether's staff told me.
Okay, so I don't know what I'd be. I'm not going to hold it up because of that, but I'd be curious. It's like, so what can we learn to how to do better from what they're doing, right? Maybe they've got some workarounds or something. So that would be good to know. Doesn't need to hold up anything going on right now. The other thing that I'm curious about is, where's those extra 25 parking spots?
So right now we have been, Forterra has not secured a place yet. And I think part of it is, I think if the counselor is okay with that, that gives them the ability to go forth and start trying to find those spots. It is always, staff has asked if the Abu Bakr Mosque would be able to provide some of those parking stalls. That is something that the mosque is going to consider. However, there's other considerations for them, such as their own parking needs. So what we would suggest, we wanted to see if the committee would be good with this, and if the counselor is good with it, we would go, and Forterra, it would be a condition of go forth and find those 25 parking stalls and provide evidence to the city that you're able to secure those.
Okay. That sounds good, too. But this is a trust issue. So the I say, yeah, go look for the 25 spots, right? But if the 25 spots don't happen, and then it's like, well, we need to get this project done, then that's a little bit of a breach of trust for me. So, but I'm just saying it. So that's, you got to find the spots. So
I think you bring up it is a trust issue. It's also how we structure the development agreement, council member. We can go and put requirements in there, like you do not even get your design review approved until you provide us evidence that you have those 25 parking stalls. We can do if thens in the development agreement. And I will say, as someone who worked on parking issues related to the Abu Bakr Mosque back, and other uses, it's always important to do that trust but verify. And there's nothing wrong with that in any type of an agreement.
Well, I'm sure, the verify wouldn't have to be the case. It's just that, like, if we don't really mean it about those 25 spaces, let's just say forget it. We don't need them. But if we're going to say 25 spaces, then they've got to find 25 spaces. That's basically it. Otherwise, let's just waive it. So that's those are my comments.
Can I add one more? I have one question or one thought. I can't remember where it was in this memo, but there was a discussion about how additional parking could possibly be created if the streets across the street, I think it was 141st, were developed with sidewalks, with gutters, all of that, with a curb, that parking could be improved in there, because currently there are no sidewalks, there are no gutters, there's no curb. So my question is it in our comprehensive plan to develop, to create sidewalks in that area? That's just a question of mine. Like, I'm just wondering whether that's even in our comprehensive plan to do that, because if we are, just my opinion, if we want this project to be successful, like, I want to see this project be successful, and we know that parking can create issues, but if there are things that we could do and invest in as a city moving forward to make that area better, to improve the area, to improve traffic flow, to improve parking, I really hope that we would look at that.
Yeah, so to answer your first question, Councilor Member, yes. When properties redevelop and there's a certain value of it, an applicant's required to put an on-street is required to do frontage improvements, which would include curb, gutter, sidewalk. And so any project that's up on, for like Tukwila Village, they added frontage improvements along 42nd Avenue. The Wadajira project, on its basic code requirement, would be that it would have to add sidewalks on South 141st. But what what we're proposing here is that they'll even do the frontage improvements on North 141st, which typically an applicant is not required to do because it's not something that fronts directly on their property. And so we do have a plan. You know, the city does want to have more sidewalks with a lot of those streets up in that area that don't have sidewalks. Of course, it's always a funding issue. Where do we provide the funds to get it? And this is an example of where we have an applicant who would do it as part of their development to add complete frontage improvements on both sides of 141st between TIB and 42nd Avenue South. Did that answer the question?
Sort of. I'm more thinking like across TIB. So I know, I understand yep. there's going to be developments of the street that's touching the property. I'm thinking more of like as a city, are we thinking about the area by the mosque even or across the street that connects the community of Riverton to walk down to Tukwila International Boulevard? That's what I'm talking about. Like, so it wouldn't be on the developer to do this. It's more of like, are we as a city thinking about development of that area?
Let me, Councilmember, it is a goal for the city to put sidewalks on along most of those streets up there. Let me see if we have anything in the capital plan. I don't believe we do currently, but I will look to see what we might have.
Okay. Or even just if it's in, because I know we're talking about the comprehensive plan now. So just let me know if it's in there, if it's not, because we will be having discussions in this committee moving forward, really thinking about or planning, basically. So I want to know.
Okay.
But I'm not holding up this. I think we're saying move it forward.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, addressing the bellwether.
Well, he said that there was no issue with the bellwether. It might be nice to have a little bit more information on that, but not holding it up.
Maybe
and you can just tell me in more detail. And then the other thing is, I'm curious about identifying the parking stalls, but you know they need to know that they have an okay to do that before they even start going there. But the Torterra does. So yeah, we need to just move it forward, I think.
Okay.
So I'm good with that.
Me too. Thank you.
So I would just confirm what we're doing is we're going to start having Public Works look at the design, and then is the committee okay with us going straight to a COW meeting when we're ready to present on everything?
Yeah, okay. I am too. I think that's okay. I just have one other question. I'll ask it in COW because I'm not going to say no. It has to do with some sun shadow. I'm not going to say don't do the development. I'll ask it later.
Okay, sounds good.
I'm curious about it. Yeah, I'll save it.
Paper packet. Thanks, Brandon. Sorry, we're so cramped today.
Yeah, we're just like,
I feel bad. I always make the committee meetings go late. Okay. Oh, she went to go get the song. All right, the last item on our agenda is zoning code housekeeping amendments. Ms. Baker, there you are, Ms. Go ahead, Deshaun's here now.
Okay, great. So I'll try to keep this brief because it is a pretty dense inspirational memo. Mainly what we're looking from the committee tonight is a request to forward this on to the Planning Commission for a work session. These housekeeping items have been accruing for the past few years. Essentially, we tried to do housekeeping items on our code, if not on an annual basis, at least every 2 or 3 years. We've kind of had a few things take priority, and then a pandemic happened, and we haven't done housekeeping in a little bit, so this is one of our larger housekeeping items. And so the question is, should we take this on to amend parts of Title 8, Title 9, which is included here, Title 17, Title 18, and Title 19. That's everything from the chapters on public peace, morals, and safety to the sign code. And essentially what you see in the CENTO memo is a summary of these proposed changes and alterations that we'd be pulling up for discussion at the Planning Commission. And we imagine that that process would take place over a few meetings with the Planning Commission. I imagine that we might not get to all items in one Planning Commission, and we'd have to bring back information for clarification. And these items would also need to go through SEPA review and then a 60-day review by the Department of Commerce. So there is kind of a lot that goes along with this process for housekeeping code amendments. Some of these things are small, things that are as simple as typos that need clarification, revisions to definitions to provide better clarification, and then some of them are larger. So we've had ordinances that were enacted, say, for the landscaping code, for example, and over the course of a few years of enforcing that landscaping code, we've noticed that there's some inconsistencies with some of our other chapters, and we've been taking notes of that and making sure that we would address and rectify that later in the future. And then another aspect of this, too, is providing some updates to our land use table. So that's the permitted uses by district. Nothing major in particular, but we would be looking to consolidate some. So some are as simple as saying we had one where it said restaurants with associated cocktail lounges and drive-throughs, and then the same thing, restaurants with associated cocktail lounges. They're redundant. The point was to say that fast food restaurants were meant to be located in some areas and some not. So we wanted to simplify it, take it down to restaurants, separate the drive-throughs out from that. So that's the one example of how those changes to the land use code play out. We're also proposing in that land use code to remove a few things that aren't consistent with larger, say, state-level uses. So, for example, we have things like taverns, nightclubs, restaurants, brew pubs, breweries, different kind of ways of essentially saying drinking establishments that may have different definitions in the WAC versus kind of what we have. And then in some cases, we don't even have a definition for that use. So we propose to adopt the definition from the WAC. That's essentially a summary. It's a lot to cover in this meeting. So that's kind of why we're hoping to kind of quickly move this to the Planning Commission, have a really robust discussion with them. And then this would ultimately come back to the PCD for further discussion as well and provide any clarifying items at that time.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Councilmember Fogarty, do you have questions, comments?
Well, I have some, but they can wait. I think it's fine. Thank you. I know it's typical for you to give a touch point here and then send it on over. But these questions I am seeing can wait because things might change anyway as or be recommended changes that are logical changes. So I'm good. Yes, thank you so much.
Great. Not so fast. I actually have a bunch of questions. Just thinking about some items that went to the Planning Commission and that came back to us, and we had to dig a little bit to find the justification, the considerations. And so there's some of this that is, as you said, housekeeping. There's some of this that is informed by situational processes that we've come across. And I would like to get, and this is just me, I'd like to know, like, what areas did we have arise when someone's looking for permits or codes that led to these proposed changes? And then, I feel good that this has to go through SEPA review because they'll ask some traditional questions. But not unlike the previous item, there are some things where just things have changed, and the DCD director has an approach that she's taking in rolling this out and kind of what parts of this are in alignment with that. Just like her presentation. So what I don't want to do is this, we send this to the planning commission, and then it doesn't come back to us with kind of the descriptive kind of exchanges, and then staff staff interpretation and proposal. And I know that that's how they've kind of, you know, that's the plan. But some of this is also the DCD department and what they've learned, what they've interfaced and taken from it. And that is a net benefit too when we talk about public service is, hey, we saw this efficiency, this opportunity, this led to this approach. We think that this will address some of the new things we're starting to see. So I would just say that for me, I'd like it to be as descriptive as possible, because if you remember when we had the other items that came to us and we had to kind of unpack and what was the original discussion and how did we end up way over here? And so I just would encourage, if there are kind of strategic plan items, the DCD directors, like, I've come across this and this is why, and it made sense, and this is the efficiency, and or staff that have done that. And then, oh, this is new. We've never thought about this. But yet we're getting applications in this way, and here's how we can meet the need. Those are the things that I have, so when it comes back, we can analyze instead of foreclosing on options that weren't considered, that then we're asked to wholesale to say, okay, we agree or don't agree. And the goal is not to reach in and say, hey, we want to do something else. So that just means that the description, the process, how it gets rolled out, we're pretty informed around the comprehensiveness of all the items. That's a lot of words, but I think I needed to be that specific so that we feel the role that we have, we feel like it's informed not only from administration, but also from the conversations that occur at the Planning Commission.
Great. Thank you for that comment. I think that makes a lot of sense. I mean, a lot of summarizing kind of this, I would say, 6 years of housekeeping items into a four-page info memo and then a couple attachments is definitely difficult to provide that whole context of why we got to these conclusions. And I would definitely like to see through the Planning Commission, some of these things may just get nixed completely for consideration, but those that remain, providing the full context of how we got to that decision. And, you know, I think one of the examples was we came up with a landscaping plan, for example, and we provided some really good options for landscaping flexibility, especially in industrial areas like that. But we then removed some of those landscaping requirements within the district development standards, and sometimes they were even inconsistent with the setbacks, and we had to kind of actually navigate through this, and it confused applicants when they looked at it the first time. And that kind of context is missing from this document, and I would, you know, very much want to bring that to the Planning Commission, and then when we come back to committee, add that context. And I think you fortunately or unfortunately would probably see a pretty dense document, but definitely to provide why we got to those conclusions.
Mm-hmm. Last comment. Not that this describes this process here, but there was one point where the Shoreline Master Program came to us without a definitive recommendation, and we had to reach in and do the heavy lifting to make sure that key things were addressed. And it was a timing issue, but also a commitment issue. And so if there are things that do get taken off the list, it would be good to get the holistic information about why, and so that we can still kind of at least be aware of and for what reason. That's it.
Great. Thank you.
When are you going to be bringing this to the Planning Commission? And the reason why I am bringing this up is because there was a inquiry from a business owner regarding the size of a fence. I don't know if the council members remember that the letter that we received from a business owner who is having, who wanted to build a 10-foot fence, but the code required, it says 6 feet, or, you know, has, is already clear about what can and cannot be developed. This is something that Councilmember McLeod brought to me as the chair of this committee. He went and visited the property owner, and wants to try to find a resolution because the property owner really wants to build the 10-foot fence. Even though staff has provided what can or cannot be built. The reason why I'm bringing this up is because I was told that if we wanted to look into this issue as part of this process, we could, if there was interest by the council to do so. And so my question for council members, but also staff, is when were you planning on bringing these housekeeping changes to the Planning Commission? Is there another committee meeting, or is there another process where this particular issue could be considered? I'm just trying to get a sense of whether this is something that we want to send through, or if this is something that we're saying, you know, that we want this to be resolved within the codes that we have currently, if that makes sense, because it would require change. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, I can speak to that. And I don't want to speak in such detail because ultimately the director was the one who was having the correspondence with Councilmember McLeod and the applicant. But as part of our review of the original template, essentially what we said in that case, the proposal was for a 10-foot fence at the property line, and anything over 6 feet tall is considered a structure. That's how our code is written. There's different requirements for a fence of that size, foundational requirements, access requirements, and things like that. So they actually have to get a building permit for that tall of a fence. You don't need to for your typical 6-foot chain link fence. And that was why we sent a correction letter saying that their options were essentially to reduce the height of the fence to 6 feet. They would still be allowed to electrify it, which was part of the proposal, was to build a 10-foot electrified fence. And they would just need to go through the building department for an electrical permit and the like. We've had a similar proposal in Tukwila South for a fence that looked to do the same. So we provided those options to the applicant. One of the big sticking points was that with the way that we have large fences or structures setback requirements, is that we measure from the property lines, and the way that this property is set up, the building spans two parcels. So technically this structure would be crossing across these two parcels and would be breaking that property line setback because the property line goes right through the middle of the building and was an additional hurdle. One of the options I know that the director provided is that because this is kind of a non-conforming, a legally non-conforming building and existed this way for some time, is that we could essentially disregard that center property line, and that may provide them with the options to still erect that fence and meet the general setbacks on the perimeter while not having to meet the setbacks of that property line that runs through the building. So anyways, there was a larger discussion. I guess I don't want to go too much further into those details because I know that that's kind of where it was left. I haven't heard of anything since the director provided those options. And the kind of thinking was that we would recommend to hold off on considering this as part of the housekeeping, essentially because the housekeeping code amendments are pretty singular. They look at kind of like one item. They may branch to another chapter where we have to, like, say, provide a definition for a land use in the code or in the table that doesn't exist. But the thing with changing these setbacks for fences and allowing for 10-foot fences would have larger impacts. So we'd have to also bring in the fire department into the discussion. We'd have to bring the building department into their requirements for foundation and siting and access. And then it may impact our landscaping code, because landscaping, required landscaping, is usually on the outside of fences over 10 feet. And there were just going to be a lot of potential consequences that we might not be able to picture if we started to consider that as part of the housekeeping. Essentially, with the housekeeping items, we're pretty aware of which other chapters or sections of the code might be impacted, but this proposal could have larger ramifications that we're not prepared to do that analysis for. And the aim was to have this go to the Planning Commission at the end of April, so getting this to move forward, I don't believe we'd have enough time to really kind of delve into how this could be in, again, our industrial areas, if we even focus just on our commercial and industrial areas. Those are big areas, the MIC, Tukwila South, Tukwila Urban Center Workplace. There could be a lot of properties affected by such a change. So I think it kind of needs to have its own item.
Thanks, Max. Thank you for the information. I'll pass that along to Councilmember McLeod and see how, have a discussion with him on how he wants to deal with it, but it doesn't seem appropriate for it to go forward with the housekeeping items. And unless other council members disagree, I'll just, we'll move this forward and I'll have a conversation with Councilmember McLeod. Thank you. All right. Great. I'm concluding the meeting.
Thank you.
Got to get the next one. Thanks, Max.